have indeed died of simply of malnutrition just today in the past 24 hours. Arada, what details do you have for us there?
Every passing hour carries more loss and more grief for the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and particularly for those in Gaza City itself, which is subjected to the Israeli brutal attacks since the beginning of the ground invasion the Israeli army announced 5 days ago. And since then, the carpet bombing of the city continues. The artillery shelling, the air strikes, the explosive laden reports that are very destructive and very damaging, and which is remarkably horrible how the Israeli occupation army is now using these explosive reports in order to level to the ground blocks, whole residential blocks and whole residential buildings, of the high-rise buildings and the still remaining buildings in the areas of Gaza City, particularly in the axis of the Israeli occupation tanks progression or advancing axis. Since the dawn of this morning, at least 20 people were killed, and the massacre was against Al-Habil family in Ashata refugee camp. 5 of the same family, including 4 children, were actually reported killed as a result of this airstrike that targeted them directly. Another attack also targeted Mahdi family in Ashata refugee camp as well. However, the number of the casualties and the number of the people who were killed as a result of these airstrikes on Ashata refugee camp is not figured for sure, actually, as the civil defense crews are not able to extract those from under the, who are dead or those who are martyred under the rubble of the destroyed buildings. As you know, the civil defense workers are working with their bare hands, without any equipment, with no vehicles, under the dangers and amidst the challenges that are accumulating and increasing every day as the Israeli occupation army is actually advancing more towards the most populated areas and committing more massacres every passing hour. Nowadays, the policy that the Israeli occupation army is using towards the Palestinians remaining in Gaza City is that pressuring them by committing massacres against them, by committing bloodshedding more of the civilians and committing massacres in order to pressure them, in order to push them or to punish them for staying in Gaza City or to push them out of the city. However, more than 900,000 Palestinians are still in Gaza City, according to Gaza Media Office. And that is not a small number. You know, the Israeli occupation army is now trying to enter a city that is already fully populated with about 1 million Palestinians. This is very horrific for most of the families who are now besieged under the Israeli fire, besieged under the Israeli occupation's brutality and brutal attacks around the hour.
Ghada, I'm afraid that is the rest. That's the only time we have left. Ghada Ibrahim, as always, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah. As always, stay safe and thank you very much for those updates. Another Israeli soldier has been killed in the Gaza Strip. The regime's military confirms the death of one of its officers during fighting in Gaza City. According to the IOF, the slain officer, identified as a company commander in the Armored Corps, succumbed to his injuries that he sustained on Monday. The IOF says Hamas operatives fired an RPG on one of the 77th Battalion's tanks belonging to the regime. This marks the first confirmed death of an Israeli soldier since Israel launched its ground offensive against Gaza City. According to the IOF, over 900 Israeli soldiers and some 70 officers have been killed since the beginning of the genocidal war on Gaza in October 2023. Many, however, believe Israel undercounts the fatalities among its troops. Well, Canada and over 20 European countries, including France and Germany, have called on Israel to restore the medical corridor between Gaza and the occupied West Bank. In a joint statement, those countries' foreign ministers expressed their readiness to provide financial support, medical personnel, and equipment to assist Palestinians who are in need of health care outside of Gaza. They urged Israel to lift restrictions on the delivery of medicine and medical supplies and to allow the United Nations and humanitarian organizations to carry out essential life-saving operations. Since October 2023, Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza has severely restricted access to medical care. Thousands of patients need medical evacuation for treatment unavailable in the besieged Strip. The Gaza-bound Global Sumut Flotilla, carrying humanitarian aid, is now in the international waters south of Greece. The flotilla's aim is to break the Israeli-imposed siege of the war-torn Palestinian territory. Our correspondent Camila Escalante earlier joined us with an update on the flotilla's location and its situation.
The majority of them, like you said, are to the south of Greece. They will be meeting up with the handful of boats that have departed from Greece. And they say that they're in the final weeks of this journey. Of course, normally they would be moving at a much faster pace, but because they have some vessels that don't have quite the capacity, it seems that it will take at least a week to get from to Gaza from where they are right now at this reduced pace. But they are within 4 or 5 days from what they consider to be a high-risk zone just outside of Palestinian waters, where historically boats have been intercepted and the detentions by the IOF have taken place. Israel continues to try to discredit the flotilla, saying that it poses a security risk and using this sort of rhetoric to manufacture consent for the possible use of lethal force against these humanitarian volunteers. Meanwhile, yesterday, the Global Sumud Flotilla put out a statement saying that they have seen drones over the boats crossing the Mediterranean in recent days.
Well, Spain has called for the admission of Palestine as a full member of the United Nations after more countries announced their recognition of the Palestinian statehood. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said the process for admitting the state of Palestine to the UN must be completed as soon as possible. He issued the call after 6 European countries, including France, formally recognized a Palestinian statehood at a high-level summit ahead of the annual UN General Assembly. French President Emmanuel Macron addressed the summit on Monday, announcing his country's recognition of Palestine as a state. The announcement drew praise from the Palestinian Authority that described it as historic and courageous, the decision taken by Paris. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also spoke at the summit, saying the statehood for Palestinians is a right, not a reward.
What is the alternative? A one-state scenario where Palestinians are denied basic rights, expelled from their homes and their land, forced to live under perpetual occupation, discrimination, and subjugation? How is this possible in the 21st century? How is it acceptable? This is neither peace nor justice. It will only increase the growing isolation of Israel on the global stage, and let's be clear, statehood for the Palestinians is a right, not a reward.
Guterres called the situation in Gaza intolerable and deteriorating, citing Israel's killing of tens of thousands of civilians, as well as hundreds of UN humanitarian workers. He stressed that nothing can justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people or any form of ethnic cleansing. The UK, Portugal, Australia, and Canada are among Western states which have joined over 150 countries that recognize a Palestinian state. In the UK, hundreds attended a ceremony at the Palestinian Mission to mark London's recognition of Palestine as a state.
Outside the Palestinian Mission in London, history in the making. The iconic Palestinian flag raised, preceded by an impassioned speech by the country's ambassador, flanked by British politicians.
This moment is not only about Palestine. It is also about Britain and the British government's solemn responsibility. It is about ending the denial of the Palestinian people's inalienable right to freedom and self-determination. And it is an acknowledgement of a historic injustice.
The ceremony follows the UK's recognition of Palestine as a state, aligning Britain with more than 140 countries worldwide.
This is now officially the Palestinian embassy in London, the country's flag atop this pole for the first time since the UK's recognition of the country. It is a symbolic but powerful moment, the participants here say, one that affirms a nation's struggle for self-determination that has gone on for far too long.
But beyond symbolism, questions remain. With the genocide in Gaza ongoing, the West Bank under occupation, and Britain's continued arms sales to Israel, does recognition mean anything?
British government recognizes Palestine carries with it responsibilities. Responsibility not to supply arms to Israel. Responsibilities not to share military information with Israel. And a demand, which we will be intensively making, for full economic sanctions against Israel, including all trade embargoes, until the occupation ends.
In the run-up to the recognition announcement, a YouGov poll found less than half of Britons saying recognition was a good idea, while only 18% disagreed.
I can understand the skepticism and cynicism with the history of this whole area. So I can understand that completely. My role as a parliamentarian and the people that I represent, and which are the good people of this country, and millions of them, will now ensure that they utilize this position to take it to the next step.
At the same time, there are other voices in Britain, like those at this debate in Birmingham, who say while recognition was long overdue, the only way forward is one state, not two.
The two-state proposition is clearly a Zionist talking point. It's designed to kick the can down the road, to continually kick the can down the road, to never, ever be in a situation where such a notion could ever be brought into existence.
For supporters here, today is about hope, solidarity, and international legitimacy. For Palestinians under bombardment, it's a reminder that recognition alone is not liberation. Saeed Purizap, London.
Well, clashes have broken out between Italian police and pro-Palestinian protesters in Milan during a day of nationwide protests and strikes aimed at denouncing the genocide in Gaza. Riot police used tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. According to Italian media, the protesters were trying to halt traffic at Milan's central station. Thousands of people also demonstrated in other Italian cities, including the capital of Rome. In the southern city of Naples, skirmishes erupted as protesters entered the city's main railway station. Grassroots unions across Italy had called for a 24-hour general strike in solidarity with the people of Gaza. Iran's president has criticized some of the world powers for adopting unilateralism and authoritarianism, as well as using their power as leverage to ruthlessly kill people in other regions. Masoud Pezeshkian made the criticism upon his departure for New York to attend the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Pezeshkian said he will try during his trip to convey Tehran's commitment to peace, security, justice, and humanity. The Iranian president ruled out talks with those who bully, sow destruction, and stir up mischief. He also condemned the Israeli actions in Gaza and denounced the countries that support the Tel Aviv regime while claiming that they support democracy and human rights. Apart from addressing the UNGA, Pezeshkian is expected to meet with world leaders and some Iranian nationals living abroad during his trip to New York. Well, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is ready to help find a diplomatic solution to the activation of the so-called snapback mechanism of the 2015 nuclear deal, provided that its interests are protected. Abbas Araghchi said Iran is ready to accept such a diplomatic solution, but it must secure the interests of the Iranian nation and address the country's security concerns. He stressed that the current situation of the 2015 agreement is the result of Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the deal. Araghchi said if the U.S. had not quit the agreement, Iran was ready to find diplomatic solutions to the existing problems. He emphasized that Iran will resist all pressures, but believes that a diplomatic solution would benefit the entire region and the international non-proliferation regime. Araghchi also met with the Director General of the UN Nuclear Agency, during which he highlighted Tehran's responsible approach to Iran's nuclear issue. He told Rafael Grossi that any progress on this issue would depend on responsible behavior of other parties and not using the UN Security Council to mount pressure on Iran. Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now. My life has been a journey, where faith is where I roam. But steps I used to walk in don't really match mine no more. I live south for the river, where children are quick to grow. Walking down the street full of distraction, for some they call it home. So take me home. Now my world has much more meaning since you came into my life. Lessons you placed in my journey, let me know you shine in your light. Right here is where you found me, as I lay in my head at night. Surround me with good intentions, as I close my eyes tonight. So take me home, I gotta find my home. So take me home, I gotta find.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, we start this episode of today's special by the name of Allah Almighty. And then we say salam to all of you, dear brother and sister, dear listener of this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. So welcome and wait. We're going to speak about etiquette of lending money. Today is Tuesday, 30th of Rabiul Awal, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 1st of the month of May, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 23rd of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. So in this day, this is today's special from IRIB English Radio, which says, Salam to all of you, dear friend. We start this episode by verse 20 of chapter Al-Muzammil from the Holy Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Inna rabbaka ya'lamu annaka taqumu adna min ثلثي الليل ونصفه وثلثه وطائفة من الذين معك والله يقدر الليل والنهار علم أن لن تحصوه فتاب عليكم فقرؤوا ما تيسر من القرآن علم أن سيكون منكم مرضى وآخرون يضربون في الأرض يبتغون من فضل الله وآخرون يقاتلون في سبيل الله فاقرؤوا ما تيسر منه وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة وأقرضوا الله قرضا حسنا وما تقدموا لأنفسكم من خير تجدوه عند الله هو خيرا وأعظم أجرا واستغفروا الله إن الله غفور رحيم.
Indeed, your Lord knows, O Muhammad, that you stand in prayer almost two-thirds of the night, or half of it, or a third of it, and so do a group of those with you. And Allah determines the extent of the night and the day. He has known that you Muslims will not be able to do it, and has turned to you in forgiveness. So recite what is easy for you of the Quran. He has known that there will be among you those who are ill, and others traveling throughout the land, seeking something of the bounty of Allah, and others fighting for the cause of Allah. So recite what is easy from it, and establish prayer, and give zakah, and loan Allah a goodly loan. And whatever good you put forward for yourselves, you will find it with Allah. It is better and greater in reward. And seek forgiveness of Allah. Indeed, Allah is forgiving and merciful.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The expression of this verse is lending Allah a goodly loan, and that is the most noble expression imaginable in this respect. Since Allah Almighty is the owner of all the possessions, and he is not expected by no means to request others to lend him a loan, but he hereby urges the believers to expend and make sacrifices in his cause and obtain merits by doing such noble deeds and tread the path of spiritual growth and attain perfection. It is noteworthy that making mention of invoking Allah Almighty for forgiveness, as mentioned at the close of such divine commands, may reflect that by acting upon such commands, man may not feel that he is perfect and Allah Almighty owes them something, but he is supposed to regard himself neglectful at all times and return toward him, since no one is able to praise Allah most benefitingly. The etiquette of lending money is the core of today's episode. Islamic teachings do not always require borrowers to provide collateral for debts. Trust is a key foundation in these transactions. While collateral may sometimes be necessary, it is not the primary requirement in Islamic debt and credit practices. If collectors rely too heavily on collateral, the intention to help often gets sidelined. Islam places high value on trust-based relationships and emphasizes consideration of the borrower's ability to repay. Lending to a relative or friend without a formal agreement still requires careful consideration. Before extending a loan, the lender should assess their own financial capacity and be mindful of the potential risks involved.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. We shall be talking about the etiquettes of lending and borrowing in Islam. The narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam also emphasize the importance of lending and introduce it as an act superior to charity or sadaqah. This is because Qard al-Hasan helps the needy person maintain their financial independence and solve their problems without humiliation. Qard al-Hasan is not only a devotional and God-pleasing act, but also have a positive impact on the economy of society. If the culture of Qard al-Hasan is institutionalized in society, many of people's economic problems will be reduced and social justice will be achieved. Therefore, it is essential to promote this culture among members of society and for Islamic and financial institutions to provide a suitable platform for facilitating Qard al-Hasana. And how about the etiquettes of lending in Islam? Lending holds a special place in Islamic teachings and is considered among the strongly recommended acts, that is, Mustahabbat Mu'akkada. This act not only unravels the material problems of believers, but also, according to narrations, carries great reward. However, abandoning it is not considered a sin. In Islam, lending has conditions and etiquettes, observing which completes their charitable act and increases its blessing.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. May this moment last forever in your hearts, in your hearts. today's special. This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life.
Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time. If you deny someone a loan, be careful of co-signing loans. This is one step to take before we lend money. If you aren't willing or able to loan someone money, they may ask you to co-sign a loan for them. A co-signer agrees to be held responsible in the event that the borrower can't pay back a lender or breaks the terms of their loan. You should be extremely cautious before co-signing a loan for someone else, as it comes with high risks and can impact your credit score. Established lenders such as banks or credit card companies may require borrowers to have a co-signer if the borrower has poor credit or no credit history, doesn't meet income requirements, is self-employed, or already has high debt. Now, this is today's special, and this is the Islamic perspective on debt. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam would supplicate to Allah to save him from debt. He would say, "O Allah, I seek refuge in you from a soul that does not satisfy, and from a heart that does not humble itself, and from a supplication not heard, and from knowledge that does not benefit, and from a deed not raised up, and from a debt that never ends." In another narration, the Prophet sought Allah's refuge from debt. When the Prophet contracted a debt transaction, he would say, "O Allah, I seek refuge in Thee from care and sorrow, from incapacity and laziness, from stinginess and cowardice, and seek refuge to Thee from the burden of debt and from being humbled by people."
What does the power of generosity do for the other person and do for you, the giver?
Giver's gain. I think the giver enjoys more than the receiver. And I'm convinced that giving is one of the basic rules of success. Well, you know, Emerson said that cause and effect was the law of laws. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. So it's in harmony with the laws of the universe. And I believe this whole universe operates in a very orderly way. I'm very tuned into laws, the laws of the universe. And I think that's why. When I could win, anybody can win. Yeah. It's just a matter of getting the right information from the right people. Mm-hmm. I think we get too much information from the wrong people.
Yeah.
And personal development today is such a well-known thing. That for anybody not to be developing themselves personally is rather sad, I think.
Yeah.
You know? So we have to help them as long as we can. Like, I don't think a person deliberately destroys themselves. I think they're misguided.
Yeah.
They're ignorant. They don't know.
Yeah.
They're lost. Yeah.
Thank you, dear brother and sister, for listening to this episode of today's special, in which we spoke about the etiquette of lending money. Shall we follow this topic? Till the next time, fi amanillah.
there's nothing who you're looking for. Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they show me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside, I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this very special edition of Face to Face. As Lebanon is still reeling from the latest Israeli war crime, the explosion of the pagers that struck civilians and fighters alike. And most of this act occurred in areas which were ordinary places, like markets, like the streets, and even among families and friends. And within this issue, we are going to be joined by the survivors of what has become as perhaps the most blatant and the most gruesome terror act committed by the Israeli regime. And this comes also in violation of international law. Now, their voices, although they carry in some instances the pain of sudden loss, at the same time, we also see the strength of resilience. And it would be very significant for the entire world to hear their voices. Today I am joined by Rida Arruz, who is a writer and a poet, but he is also a husband and father. I'm also joined by Zainab Mustrah. She is a newlywed, and of course they are joining me here today to give their testimony to the entire world about what is happening to them today, a year on this terror act. Let me begin first of all with Rida Arruz. I would like to know, really, and I want the world to know, what went on in your mind just as this pager exploded? What did you think it was? Did you think it was a specific assassination against you? Were you surprised to see that there were many others like you, and most of the ambulances and the people were rushing to take those wounded into the hospitals?
Just before the explosion, I was at work, but I could have been at home. Many who were subject to this explosion were at home with their families. It could have been close to my daughter, and she would sometimes hand it over to me when it beeped. I was at my office and really focused on work. Usually, I don't give attention to the pager when it beeps, but it beeped this time longer than usual, and that led me to check what the issue is. When I held it to my face, there was a message which read, "Pager error, press OK." But when I first held it, I realized that it was extremely heated, and I had the feeling that I should throw it out of my hand. But I was in a closed and isolated room. It was a matter of seconds and the pager exploded. And at that moment, I felt that something had happened to my hand and my left eye. The eyesight in my right eye was gone completely. My colleague was with me and he was down. I woke him up and he said it was a drone strike. I told him, no, it wasn't a drone strike. They detonated the pagers. You might ask me how you were certain that it was Israel that detonated the pagers. To tell you honestly, I always felt uneasy having this device, but I never thought, and no one would think, that such a satanic plot is possible and that anyone could plant explosives in this device. When it exploded, I knew there was something that we could not fathom. This was not a malfunction. Maybe some thought the lithium batteries blew up and that this was a result of a malfunction. But I knew it was a deliberate act of detonating explosives, and I knew there were explosives in the pagers. I knew it was Israel, and I knew we wouldn't even find an ambulance car available. I was not surprised. Of course, I couldn't see anything then, and it took 15 minutes till they brought a car and took me. And on the way, we can hear the sounds of sirens from ambulance cars and the mayhem that the issue caused. We arrived at the first hospital, then the second and the third. Still, there were no places. One hospital said, maybe we can receive you, maybe not. I was barefoot and I walked for around 150 meters in the sun on a route that was filled with glass. It took several days to remove the glass from my feet. Even when I went to Iran, the doctors were still removing glass from my feet. I had to go on foot for a certain distance, hoping to get to a hospital where help can be provided. And since there was no ambulances, my friend took me in a minivan, and we didn't find the hospital till we reached Saida. I wasn't surprised to know that a big number of people were targeted, because the scenario that was playing in my mind led me to know that there would be many like me. But what struck me was that I started hearing the voices of people I know at the same hospital. One of the paramedics who later was killed in the war was my relative. He came into the hospital and saw me there and tried to comfort me with a few words. When I reached the hospital, I felt that now I can give in and fainted after having stayed for around 2.5 hours alert and bleeding, and there was unbearable pain. But I had another concern that the man taking me in his car found out that his brother too was wounded and he was nervous. This made me also tell myself and him that if we see that a hospital is overcrowded, then we won't enter. I wanted to make way for those who required urgent medical attention. I felt that I wanted all the victims to be treated before me. I can handle my wounds, I told myself. Maybe others can't, although my injury was serious. Surprisingly, many of the wounded I knew had the same exact feeling. They told the nurses, we can bear it, treat the others that need urgent help.
That proves your humanity even in such circumstances. Zainab, I want to ask you, as a woman, you're a civilian. You're not an armed fighter. You're not a military personnel. How did that occur? Did you expect that a pager or beeper, which is used in hospitals by doctors and nurses, to explode in your house? And did it explode in your house? This is also another question.
My name is Zainab Mustra. I'm 27 years old. I studied interior design and hold a diploma in public relations and marketing. It was a day like any other, an ordinary day in the life of any young woman. I was working on my laptop when I got up to fetch something. As I was returning, I heard the pager ringing in this strange way. A feeling came over me that something was wrong. I hesitated between going closer to check or staying away, but before I could decide, it exploded. I wasn't even holding it. There was some distance between me and the device. Unlike Sayyid Rida, I never imagined such a horrific massacre could be carried out. Even when I was wounded, I thought maybe it was a technical malfunction. At the hospital, I still didn't know what had really happened. When I stepped out of the car, hearing people's voices, I told myself maybe the pager exploded by accident, and what was happening outside was maybe an explosion similar to the car explosion of 2014. Never once did I think pagers had been booby-trapped, and we know that many carry it around casually. This shows how the Israeli enemy has no morality. Though it claims to be an ethical adversary, in reality it has no ethics, no moral army. Even in war, there are rules, but Israel has crossed every line. They didn't even think about the children and the infants and women who would be victims of this massacre.
Rida, let me come back to you. You said that you expected that there would be many like you, maybe, I don't know, in the hundreds or thousands. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, right after this terror act, He said that the Israelis were planning on assassinating at least 5,000 Hezbollah fighters, and along with them, the other civilians who are surrounding them, maybe in their houses or maybe in the common areas. Did you think that this was an act, a divine act from God Almighty, that perhaps there was a reason why they exploded maybe earlier than the Israelis had expected, that the casualties, we're talking about maybe 12 or so, not more, who were killed as a result of this act. Of course, we have a huge number of wounded, but still the casualties, based on what we learned from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that it was not as the Israelis really wanted. But they are boasting that this is a huge achievement for them, whether at the intelligence level and even at the military level.
على مستوى إن كان هذا إنجاز أم ليس إنجاز نحن بنيجي بنقول هذا إنجاز على المستوى النظري.
As to whether this is an achievement or not, on a theoretical level, if you want to call it an achievement, it's a cheap one. This is not military work. I am part of the resistance, and during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and the support phase, my biggest concern was not to be targeted because of negligence or carelessness on my part. If I was struck by a drone while active in the field, that would be different. It's part of war. But this, to plant explosives in a civilian device, that's not warfare, that's treachery. That is pure malice and cowardice, avoiding direct confrontation because of an inability to fight us on the battlefield. This is a cowardly act. We told the enemy, come, use all your military tools and face us. I would know how to face it. For them to resort to this, it's backstabbing. This is more than cowardice and satanic, since they have no ability to face us directly. I am certain the enemy resorted to this because it cannot face us on the battlefield. This is certain. For 66 days, this was proven. So they resorted to cowardly methods. What I'm trying to say is, no matter what the result, this was not an achievement. Even if they had prepared 30,000 pages to explode, the outcome was still limited. We learned that 50,000 pages had reached Lebanon, and they were preparing to detonate 30,000. Every intelligence operation has a deadline. It could not be delayed longer. The pages reached us before Al-Aqsa Flood. I had received mine 2 weeks earlier. At a certain point, we already suspected something was wrong. The batteries would heat up and so on. The Israelis knew the resistance was growing suspicious. In the end, Israel was forced to detonate before reaching its target. Only 5,000 pages had been distributed. They had planned to hit tens of thousands, but only a few thousand devices were triggered, producing many wounded but very few martyrs. The purpose wasn't primarily to kill but to disable, to take these servicemen out of service. Why? Because they couldn't pack larger quantities of explosives without being detected. They can only put a few grams of explosives, not because they are merciful, but so they would not be detected. In military terms, there is something called a killing ambush. If I prepare such an ambush, the enemy could be caught in it and should not survive. But here, Israel set its trap, which was a rare opportunity and a theoretical plot that can only happen once, and they spent so much on it and prepared for it. The result, however, as if out of 30, only 4 were actually hit, and even those 4 weren't eliminated. This was Israel's one-time opportunity to execute its diabolical scheme, but in actuality, they failed miserably. No matter how much they boast or how many golden pages they gift the great Satan, it was not the great achievement they claim, and they will never have another chance. Out of 4,000 wounded, how many were truly taken out of service? Only a few hundred at most. Many of those injured are still active, still present. Among the roughly 400 who sustained eye injuries, dozens, perhaps a few hundred, lost their sight. Yet, even blindness did not take them out of service. They are still active, still strong, still fighting. We are followers of Ali ibn Abi Talib. We are followers of Maitam al-Tammar, who was crucified on a palm trunk, his limbs severed, his tongue cut out. Yet even then, he remained a soldier confronting tyrants. If he had been alive and nailed to that tree, he would still be leading in jihad despite his wounds. That is our example.
المثقلي بالجراح المعلق على النخلة قائدا في جهاد التبيين كما كان قائدا في كل جبهات الجهاد.
I want to talk to you about how active you are now despite the fact that you have lost your eyesight, but let me ask Zainab, how has your life changed? I mean, as a woman, as someone who was engaged, getting ready for marriage, getting ready for a new life, how has this act and this, these wounds, how have they changed your life and the life of your family?
No one can deny that life has changed. Someone who once went and came freely, who others relied on, now must rely on others. Of course, my life has changed. But this experience has made us stronger and taught us many things. We cannot be weak. The enemy's goal was not to kill. If that had been the goal, they would have put more explosives. Their aim was to paralyze these 4,000 people so they would be a burden on their resistance. But as I have seen from my own experience and from sitting with other wounded, this attack only increased our strength and determination to go on. Even recently, some of the injured sat for official exams and ranked among the top in Lebanon. Israel may have been closed one door of jihad for us, but we are searching for other doors through our wounds to continue. Surely this injury is not an obstacle. I was engaged, and after the attack, this did not stop me and my partner from staying together and having a family. We will continue, we will build families, and those families will also fight Israel. This only create more hatred and enmity between us and Israel, especially for the women who were injured. It is usually the men who are wounded in battle, but women will have even greater determination than the men because of the oppression against them.
Let me come back to you, Rida. You're very active now, even in your current state. You have your own program on one of the local radio stations, political satire, and you're saying that you can do so much. There's so much that you can do. And some people would say that someone in your status would need not only medical care, but also psychological care. But it seems from your friends and family who I spoke to, they told me that you are the one who is giving them this type of support. So where do you get this strength?
On the psychological level, I want to say something. Perhaps one could see it as coming from God. I had just turned 40, and I felt I had lived much of my life in sacrifice for the sake of God. I had spent years on the front lines. I used to pray, asking God to draw me closer to Him. I felt that in the routine of my daily work, my heart was not being purified enough. What I needed was not a small shake, but a strong one. So I asked God for this strong shake, but I did not know through which door it would come. When the pager rang, the enemy wanted to be a door to my physical and spiritual death. I do not believe they could truly kill us with a pager or with a landmine. These devices are mechanically limited. They can only carry so much material. Their aim was to kill our bodies and also our spirits. But I saw that ringing sound instead as a bell calling me to a new door of God's mercy and kindness. The first thing I did when others went to fetch a car was to throw myself on the ground. I didn't collapse. I deliberately lay down and said, "My Lord, praise be to you. What I had been asking for, it seems you answered." I didn't know which door you would choose, but if this is it, I submit to you. I told him, "This life you gave me, I offer it back to you as a sacrifice in your path. If you still want me to remain, leave me here to be active, present, and pleasing you. But allow me to do something. But if my time is over, then let me go to you while bleeding in peace." Yet, at that moment, I felt strongly that God wanted me to stay, and he had given me the blessing of sight. And though the enemy tried to take it away, he would restore it. Indeed, within 2 months after surgeries, I regained my vision. More recently, after further operations, I could no longer see. But I am certain in my heart that I will regain my sight. And this is God's promise to me, and I have full trust in Him. On the level of morale, my principle is, the more positive spirit I spread among those around me, the more strength returns to me. I push myself forward. I show others that I am still active and capable, so they will trust my ability to cope. At the same time, I do not pretend to be a superhero. I tell people honestly, I lost some abilities, but I search for ways to compensate. I lost the ability to perform one function, but I gained the ability to perform many others. During this stage, I read about the lives of many great figures who were blind, yet still highly influential. While I was laying in the hospital just a week after, I began reading again. I began planning the new course of my life, how I would rebuild it, on what foundations and with what mission. I took inspiration from others who had been tested by different hardships and still managed to rise again. I adopted one guiding rule. What did I lose? How will I compensate? And how will I build a new path? At every step, there is a new challenge to overcome. We were raised to see every obstacle as a challenge. And when challenged, we are provoked to rise and surpass it. This is what our leaders taught us. This is how we were raised, in the resistance and in life.
Zainab, what is your message to the world, to leaders, to the leaders of Lebanon, for example?
Like Rida said, God could have chosen me to be a martyr. When the explosion occurred, sometimes I lamented, asking God, why didn't you allow me to be a martyr? But then I was convinced that God kept me alive because I have a message and I have an important role in this life. If I had no role, then God would have taken me. Now I have changed. I was the timid Zainab that almost never spoke out on television. Now I need to tell the world about the oppression I'm living and to show how unethical and cowardice this enemy really is, causing such a massacre. Disregarding the targeting of women and children, I want to show the world that facing this immoral enemy, we are strong and we will not be weakened or intimidated, and we will not allow the enemy to achieve its goal.
Thank you, Rida. Final question for you. We mentioned that you're also a political analyst. You're not just a writer and a poet. And your show shows how, in a few minutes, you can let people understand the political situation in Lebanon, maybe more than in any other way. How do you see the future now? And do you think that Israel fears Rida Ruz now, the wounded, more than it feared Rida Ruz before?
There is a trending statement that is used these days, which is restricting state control or reinstating the full authority of the government in Lebanon. It's remarkable that the main question on our minds, which is asked by citizens in all of Lebanon, from the north to the south, where is the government? This question, if asked in any other country, would not be normal or logical. But in Lebanon, it's very logical to ask where the government is when the roads are cut, but the policeman is giving tickets. Where is the government when the electricity comes once a year, like a holiday, but an employee comes to give you the electricity bill? The same question is asked in the banks, the hospitals, the schools, and government institutions. In all places where the government should be, you will ask that question, but you will not find it because it's not there. It's only a formal decor of a government which is not even decorated. Now they tell us, hand over your weapons because the government has to restrict authority. I told them, other issues can be solved in politics. You take people's money from the banks, you don't provide good health care, the school system is down and there are no good roads even. I can't find the government to help,